Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to read a good book. And it's a little rainy here today, but it's still glorious here in Clearwater, Florida. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Jim DeFelice. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. He'll tell me in a minute. Because we are going to be talking about Omer Bradley, General at War. This is a wonderful book, and I am so happy that I have this opportunity to talk to him about it, because it is a perfect gift book for anyone who had any family in World War II or for any vet. So thank you so much for joining me today, Jim. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, Patsy, and thanks for having me on.
Well, as I said, you know, of course, this book was written quite some time ago, but that's what I do on this program. I don't like to forget books, you know.
Well, you know, it's great because the publisher has been, keeping it in print. Just came out with a whole bunch of, I'm not exactly sure, you know, how they set these printing presses and all that machinery, you know, out to work, but they you know, cranked them up, got some more of them out there, so there's plenty for sale, and we're getting, you know, there's been kind of a resurgence of interest in World War II in general, and certainly in Omer Bradley. So thank you very much for having me on.
Well, I think partly, of course, it's because we're at war again in Europe. I mean, like, whoa, we don't get over it.
Well, that is kind of an unfortunate, I guess it's a human condition right now, and, you know, hopefully at some point in the future we kind of evolve so that we don't really need that sort of conflict.
Well, I'm so happy particularly to talk to you about Omer Bradley, because my father served under Omer Bradley. My father was in D-Day, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he loved Omer Bradley, which is what all the GIs loved Omer Bradley. So this book, I think, it's timely, because we do want to know, I think, we're looking a little bit more perhaps at the military and what exactly, you know, when we need a general, we need a general. So that's why I thought this was a perfect time to talk about this book. So let's lay the groundwork for those people who don't know who Omer Bradley was and why he is so important to the entire winning of World War II.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and the parallel to today, you know, I think it's very important, because even people who are not interested in the military, I mean, Bradley really, in a lot of ways, is a good example of a leadership style that is very much in vogue right now. But to go back to Bradley, he's born out in Missouri, out in Randolph County. I think that the town where he originally was born and spent his, you know, very original formative years, had a really huge population, 300 people. There may have been more cattle there than people, but he was lucky enough to
Just a moment. I hate to stop you. Do you hear a clicking or a sort of a?
No, I don't.
It's okay. Okay, my guy in the control room says it's okay. All right, let's go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, maybe Bradley kind of done it coming in. You know, he didn't really like to be in the center of attention, you know, in the spotlight. So maybe he's from the great beyond is saying, hey, don't spend all this time talking about me. Talk about my soldiers. You know, like Patsy's dad or grandparents and the thousands, the millions, actually, of others who served under him. But he was, you know, kind of a middle American guy. Was raised. His father was a school teacher. And as a young boy, he would walk to a couple miles, actually, to the one-room schoolhouse where his father was originally teaching. And they were very close. And Bradley was actually a pretty smart, bright kid, as I guess you have to be if your dad is the teacher of the school. But unfortunately, his father passed away before he became a teenager, and his mom moved them to a little bit bigger town, and they went to school there and also worked. And Bradley did have some ambitions. He started towards the end of high school. He started working for the railroad. Basically, he graduated. He started as basically sweeping the floor, and then was helping build steam engines. Now, but he wanted to go to school. He wanted to or continue his education. He wanted to go to college, and he had a plan to do that. He's trying to save up money. Now, that's not very easy at the time. He's being paid the princely sum of 17 cents an hour. Hopefully, that was a good wage if we're sweeping floors, but wasn't quite enough for college. And one day, he was speaking to his Sunday school teacher, actually. And the teacher said, you're a bright kid, what do you want to do with your life? And Bradley kind of said, oh, I'd like to be a lawyer and go to this college, et cetera. I'm saving up my money. And the Sunday school teacher said, you know what? Have you ever thought about going to West Point? And it's a great school. He's talking up. And Bradley said, well, I don't think I could afford that. The teacher laughed at him and said, no, they actually pay you to go to West Point. because that's where the Army trains its officers. And to make a long story short, Bradley studied up at the time in order to get the local congressman's approval. You had to take a 4-day test. Bradley was very, very, was always very strong in math. He'd be on a plane and he would be working out those very difficult algebra problems. Just kind of relax. So math was his best subject, but English, social studies, or history at the time, they called it, and geography, those were tougher. So he studied. Went there, took the exam, worked his way through all those subjects, comes to the math exam, and his head went blank. It was gone. It totally blank. Sitting there for hours, and finally, this equation kind of drops in, however that works, and this one. Somehow, he managed to remember enough math that he got a passing grade in that and aced the others. He was actually, or had started as the number two candidate to go to West Point under this congressman's nomination, but the number one fellow failed all the tests. And so Bradley went to West Point, and the rest became history.
And he found his rightful place. And, it's so wonderful when I think about my dad. And a few days after D-Day, he did something. He saved his platoon, and he received the Silver Star, and then of course you went on, and then there was the Battle of the Bulge. But among his fondest memories, the two that he always talked about was getting to meet Omar Bradley and getting to have Marlene Dietrich sing to him. So
that is wonderful. Well, first of all, God bless your father for his service, for saving those men, and for his contributions, really, for our future, our present now, not just to your dad, but to all of the men and women who served during the war. A lot of soldiers have stories about meeting General Bradley. There are several. And most of these, I think, are true, although I have to admit that when I was doing the research, that in some cases I got them from people still alive, but they had heard it from someone else. There are many instances where, he stopped, gave some, back in England, gave some nurses a ride back, or some sergeants a ride, In one case, he gave a young, I think it was a private who was directing traffic, but in really bad weather, he gave him his coat. He was just that kind of warm fellow. But you know, you mentioned Marlene Dietrich. I have a confession about the book. Okay, so every writer wants their book to do well, right? We want a big splash. We want big coverage. We want news stories and television, and you know, all we've dreamed, you know, of all that. And you know, the best way to get that is with, well, let's face it, with, you know, a little scandal. I have to say, Omar Bradley, certainly to the point when I was writing the book, it was not really known for scandal. But then I found out that he had that, and probably right around the time that your dad heard Marlene Dietrich, Omar Bradley had Marlene Dietrich to dinner, and she was a guest at his headquarters, and they spent a lot of time together. Well, I have to say, I would not have been a writer if I did not sense that there was great scandal there. And I dug, and I talked, and I found people, and one of Bradley's aides was still alive. Actually, several of Bradley's aides were still alive, but one specifically from that period was still alive, although unfortunately his health wasn't all that great. But anyway, I dug and dug and tried to, you know, to put them a little bit, you know, to get beyond dinner. Unfortunately.
Now, did you happen to talk to her grandson, Peter Riva?
I did not. Was there? And you know,
because
maybe there was scandal there.
he's been on my program a number of times because he is a fine writer. He writes thrillers.
Oh my goodness!
And,
see, I missed that.
Yeah, and I bet Peter could tell you exactly what.
Well, there you are. Maybe there's a whole nother edition. Somehow, though, I have to say that having spent quite a lot of time with Omar Bradley, with people who knew, I should say, obviously he passed away well before I was working the book. I have to think if there's a general if there's any man in the Army who was a total gentleman, let's say, to Marlene Dietrich, it was Omar Bradley.
I agree. I think he was a gentleman, and I think my father would have thought so too. And he adored, of course, all of my childhood, whenever a black and white Marlene Dietrich movie would come on, my father would be there and the whole family would sit around and watch her. So I was so thrilled when I started this radio program and I landed up having her grandson as a guest.
That is phenomenal. You know, it's great to meet so many people in what you do, obviously, also as a writer at that and Patton's grandson, John Wayne's son. You know, it's just amazing.
It is.
You know, wow, I grew up.
I call them those magic threads that sort of flow through the tapestry of Joy on Paper. Now, let's talk about before the war. What was Omar Bradley's position? Did he realize that we're going to have a major war? When did this start happening for him?
Well, I think the Bradley graduates with class of 1915, and that is World War One is going on in Europe. Obviously, America has not yet joined, and you know, he gets, he's a young lieutenant, and he gets some, you know, just typical young lieutenant type job. When America joins the war, he, like every young lieutenant, you know, is eager to go over to Europe, and he doesn't go. He's assigned to different things, and unfortunately for him, his ambition to be in combat. Luckily for a lot of people, they still are not killed, but the war ends, and you know, Bradley becomes a career officer, kind of works his way up. He does has a number of jobs. He's known as good tactical officer, someone who's very good with tactics and history tactics. And he happened at one point to work for a colonel named George Marshall, who at the time is just a colonel, but he's somebody that as the 20s turn into the 30s, his career is really taking. And that relationship helps propel Bradley kind of to the top rung of the Army leadership. Now, I should note that most of the majority of that work, not the majority, but a huge portion of the class of 1915 do become generals, so not just Bradley. But when before America joins World War II, Pearl Harbor, there's a huge buildup, and Bradley is one of the key figures in terms of training men, figuring out tactics, that sort of thing. The Army's Officer Corps is relatively small. He, of course, knows George Patton. As a matter of fact, he and Patton were assigned at different points. Patton is somewhat ahead of him career-wise. They're in Hawaii, and Patton, at the time, had a nice little shooting club over there, shooting clay pigeons. And Bradley came, and Bradley, I have to say, was an excellent shot from a young man. And Brad goes over, and he wants to try out for the shooting team. Patton, okay, kid, come on. And Paul, I'm not sure many of your listeners, I'm sure, y'all are familiar with the process. The play goes up, you take a shot. Well, Bradley, a little bit nervous, misses his first shot. All right. Tries again. The second shot. Now, at this point, Patton's ready to just go home, pack it in. But Bradley, being Bradley, asks for the next shot, and the next one, 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 and nails the 25 plays in a row. Pat looks at him and says, I guess you'll do. And that's pretty much Patton in a nutshell, and Bradley also in a nutshell. He didn't, neither one of them, I should say, ever gave up. Patton was very, very flashy. Bradley was far more laid back, but they worked together in Africa. They worked together in Sicily. They go to prepare for D-Day, and Eisenhower turns things around. Bradley younger and generally lower rank, career had been under Patton. Now Eisenhower decides to put Patton under Bradley. Bradley doesn't really think that that's going to work out, but it turned out fantastically. And I think that if you examine Patton's record, he is by far the best while he was under Patton.
While
he was under Bradley.
Well, what we all have to do is learn more about Omar Bradley. And, I got this interview a little bit late, but I wanted to get it before Christmas. I had this slot, but this isn't, I haven't had enough time to talk to you about Omar Bradley or about your other books, because I probably should have done a great introduction. I didn't want to take too much time to tell people. I'm sure that, they're all interested in the work that you did, of course, with Navy SEAL Chris Kyle and the memoir, American Sniper, and then later on, your other books. You have so many wonderful books, and the new book, I think the newest one is West Like Lightning, which I am very interested in. It's a Pony Express one, and you have so many things to tell us and talk about that I'd like to invite you back to come in February. And February 12th is Omar Bradley's birthday, and perhaps you could give me the whole hour, and we could talk about all of your books, okay?
I would love to.
Because right now I just want to tell people this book is just wonderful. If you want to play Secret Santa, buy this book and just send it to a vet, any hospital for veterans, because the veterans will really appreciate it. They love to have books. They need books, and so just, you know, send a book to your local vet hospital or to a senior's home where you know that there are veterans, because this is a wonderful gift. And it's a gift for for anyone who had a relative in D-Day, in the Battle of the Bulge, your grandfather, your uncle. This is a book that you want to read. It's a wonderful read. Jim is a great writer. That's why he's a New York Times bestselling author. But he also brings the story to life. Omar Bradley is fascinating, and he puts it into perspective. I think a lot of people will really understand World War II better from reading this book. So this is a perfect gift book for any vet you know, for anyone who had any family in World War II in Europe. And I would like to just suggest that it's a great gift book. And Jim, you're going to come back in February. We'll talk more about Omar Bradley. I'd like to go actually through from D-Day down to the Battle of the Bulge. And then, of course, we'll talk about Westlake Lightning and your other books, okay?
Oh, I'd love to. And you're really too kind. And now after hearing all that, I'm afraid that my head will have swollen so big I'm not going to be able to get out the door. But I really appreciate all those kind words.
Okay, so mark your calendar. You're going to be back here in February. We'll celebrate Omar Bradley's birthday and your wonderful writing. So just tell people your website so they can go there.
It's very easy. It's Jim DeFelice. That's JimDeFelice.com. And, of course, hopefully you can buy everybody's buying books online these days, but if you go to your local bookstore and they don't have it, I guarantee that they'll be more than happy to order it.
Okay, and you pronounce your name Felice, DeFelice.
Well, you know, anything that doesn't include a four-letter word with, I'm very good with.
Well, it's
DeFelice.
DeFelice. It's a lovely name. And you're going to be back here in February, and we'll celebrate Omar Bradley's birthday, and it'll be just in time for Valentine's Day, too. So another reason for people to buy your books, okay?
Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
We'll go to commercials.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am so happy because I have somebody on the phone who I know she could do a curtsy. Leslie Carroll. Hi, Leslie.
Patsy with a Z. Warmest wishes of the holiday season to you and your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Oh, my listeners love you.
I love it. I have to practice my curtsy because part two of Meghan and Harry's Netflix season is on tonight, and I binged the first three episodes, much to my husband's chagrin, and I don't know what time they drop the next three, but I have to practice my curtsy, and my knees are not what they used to be.
But I'm sure you will do it the right way, because
yes.
you are so spectacular.
Right knee, right leg goes in the back, right knee, and you don't have to do a full court plié. This is not Louis XIV.
Exactly. I know. And you could probably do some of the dances, too. So
I used to know them when I was working on my Marie Antoinette novels, and we'll get to that at the end of our interview because I have a little surprise for everybody.
Okay.
I learned all of that stuff.
I know. And you would do it so beautifully and so gracefully and look so beautiful because I still, of all the authors that I've interviewed, I love the photo on your homepage. I just like to click on it and look at you. You look so...
Yes, me as Marie Antoinette. I had that dress made for me, and I still have that dress. It's in storage, and I lost some weight, and I didn't want to get rid of it because it's still... I mean, it was made for me. I found somebody, I think on Etsy, that made me that dress, and I picked out the fabric and everything, and there was some company that I found, I think, on the West Coast, maybe Portland, Oregon or something, that makes these period undergarments, and they do it for opera companies and theater companies and that sort of thing. So they made the corset, and they made the panier, the baskets on the side, the undergarments that tie with the pockets and the petticoats. I have all of that still in storage. And my husband is like, we're still paying for that? And I'm like, oh, you never know.
You never know. You might.
And the wig.
And you might be invited to Versailles. You know?
I did a book signing at Versailles a couple of years ago. I found the first book, the first of the Marie Antoinette trilogy, Becoming Marie Antoinette, which is about her childhood in Schönbrunn in Austria, and this incredible physical and educational makeover that she had to have in order to prepare her to become Dauphine of France. She had to undergo all of this rigorous makeover in order to for Louis XV, who was king at the time, to accept her as being eligible Dauphine material for his grandson. And this novel is all about her childhood and her first couple of years at Versailles and all of the backbiting of the French courtiers. And it is sort of the mean girls of Versailles. She went to France as a teenager, 14 years old, married to a boy who was 15 who she never met till the day before they were married. And I found the first book was on sale in the gift shop at Versailles. And there I am speaking French and asking the manager of the bookstore. I had such chutzpah. I said, "Is there anybody here? I'm here in France for a week. Can I do a book signing?" And the next thing I know, they arrange it for that Saturday, and they put up flyers everywhere saying that this author is going to be at Versailles for one afternoon. They were wonderful.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, you have so much fun with royalty.
I love it. You know, Patsy, the way I think of it is, they're really just like us. The families are just as dysfunctional, et cetera, although some are inbred, mm-hmm. which I assume most of our families are not. But they're just like us, only they have better clothes and jewelry than most of us.
That's what makes it fun for us. And
of course. We love watching them because we don't have them. And you know, we fought a revolution so that we didn't have to have royalty. So we get to sit back at home and watch The Crown or these other things and think, okay, we can watch them on television and we can admire them or we can envy them or we can say, oh, thank God we're not like that family. And we're in the safety of our living room.
And now, with your wonderful recordings, people can hear about a lot of juicy scandals.
Oh, this was a dream come true, Patsy, to bring them to life. My husband and I spent the last 6.5 years in Denver because he had a job offer there. And the day we moved back to New York in March, we drove a U-Haul across the country with half of our own possessions, the rest to follow. And I'm standing in the back of the U-Haul, and I get an email from my literary agent saying that Blackstone Audio had offered for my nonfiction royal books to turn them into audiobooks. Finally. And I said, yes, as long as I get to narrate them.
Of course.
Because I'm sure, as your readers know, I started out as a classically trained actress, et cetera, et cetera. And I had done the audiobook of the first Marie Antoinette novel, and I've done audiobooks for many other authors and all of that. So I said, these books were written with a certain tone. And the Chicago Tribune had said that my nonfiction books were the perfect marriage of People Magazine and the History Channel. And I thought, they need to find somebody that can understand that style, the, hey, pull up a chair, I've got a great juicy story about Anne Boleyn to tell you, and guess what, you know something, it's really all true. This isn't a novel, this really happened.
And
it needed that kind of voice, and I felt I needed to tell that rather than the sort of museum voice. Ladies and gentlemen, if you look on your left, you'll see a tapestry that was, you know, created in 1532. That was not the voice we needed. So I had so much fun narrating these, and they've come out. There were 5 books in total, Royal Affairs, Notorious Royal Marriages, Royal Pains, Royal Romances, and Inglorious Royal Marriages, which is all the schadenfreude of the worst possible ones. And they've been coming out once a month on the second Tuesday of every month, and they're on Amazon, and they're on Audible. And the one that just dropped this week was Notorious Royal Marriages. And in January, Royal Affairs, which was the first one that I wrote, actually, that will finally come out on audio. And there will be some updates. So for listeners who've been waiting for the audiobook version all these years, times have marched on, of course. The laws of succession have changed in England. For those who like the real baddies of history, since Royal Pains was published in paperback, Richard III, who's one of those in Royal Pains, his corpse, his skeleton, was discovered in a car park in Britain. So I got to add all of that information for the audiobook. And, of course, Prince Charles, who is covered in both Royal Affairs and Notorious Royal Marriages, he's now King Charles. So there's new information for those books.
Well, nobody else could record them the way that you can do it. You have the voice. You have the enthusiasm. You just know these people.
Oh, I had so much fun. I did the accents, too, because that's part of my background, accents and dialects. And when I did Royal Romances, for instance, and it's not just Britain, it's the continental Europe. For instance, in Royal Romances, one of the great romances of Europe was between Catherine the Great and Potemkin, who, by the way, the Potemkin villages were real. That was propaganda. He really did colonize the Crimea. And she went and she visited, and she named him her viceroy and everything, and they may have had a secret marriage. But they used to communicate with each other in these messages, and they would send these couriers throughout the vast palaces in Russia. He'd be in one end of the palace, and she'd be in the other, and they'd write notes to each other the same way people would text today. And she would send him a note, and he would write back on the same piece of paper. And then she would write him back on the same piece of paper. And I'm sure that their couriers got a great workout running from one end of a palace to the other. And I was doing the voices of she, of course, Catherine the Great was actually German. And she never really lost her German accent. It was a little bit of a muddy Russian. I kept thinking of Anna Delvey, that fake heiress with the, you are so basic, but I didn't do her. But I came up with an accent that was really what I thought was mostly German with a smidge of Russian thrown in, and of course he was Russian. And there are scenes where the two of them have these messages that are going back and forth as if they were text messages that they wrote to each other. And so it's her German accent and his Russian accent and going back and forth between the accents. It was great fun.
Oh.
And then, of course, in Mary, Queen of Scots, some people may not know that she always had a French accent, not Scottish. She was raised in France. And she didn't return to Scotland until she was 18 years old. So she had this very soft accent. Don't believe what you see in the movies. She had this very soft accent that was mostly French.
Oh, I think it would be just thrilling to have the video on you as you're doing the recordings.
Oh, it was fun. I was wildly gesticulating. I was having a grand time imagining these people in the settings where they were and bringing them to life. And I found myself, especially in the chapter where the Potemkin Catherine the Great romance, where of course he died before she did, and she's writing a letter to a friend of hers who's German, and of course everything I've written is in English, but she's eulogizing him and how much he meant to her. It's a very private letter, but we have the translation of it in my book. And I realized as I started writing it, it's just deeply personal how she felt about him as a woman talking about a man, not an empress talking about a viceroy. And I started to tear up. I really became very emotional, because it was so deeply personal to him, and I just let that happen.
Oh, this is so much fun. I am so happy that you got to do this, because it was needed, and it as with this whole interest in the, you know, what's going on in royalty right now, I think this is going to be a big hit, because it's fun, and people will hear that. People will hear this
from your mouth.
In your voice, just is wonderful, and the way you tell the story, and all of the, you know, research you did over the years. It's
exactly. Each nonfiction book has a bibliography in the back of about 60 different books and many, many different websites that I visited, and the research was ongoing in a way, because I realized that because time had marched on since the books were first published in paperback, things have happened. The laws, as I said, Patsy, the laws of succession have changed. For instance, if you look at William and Catherine's children, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, well, now the Prince and Princess of Wales. Even so, time has marched on, and I had to change their chapter for the end of Royal Romances, because they're no longer the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, and they've had three children since I finished that chapter and all of that. Initially, Princess Charlotte would, because she was born, she has a younger brother, she would still have been bounced down the line of succession, but now she will still come before her younger brother Louis, instead of after him,
and that's
because,
of course,
now it's by age, not by gender.
That's of course, that's what Queen Elizabeth wanted, and over the past few weeks, as this drama has grown and grown, I've been thinking a lot about you, and because I know for you, you had two grandmothers who were important in your life, and I think now of Queen Elizabeth and how she would look at this situation. She was, a grandmother to, and I wonder what she would think of the current situation, because as my listeners know, you wrote a really wonderful, wonderful story called American Princess, the love story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. You were there. You were in Windsor. You were there for the wedding. You were reporting on it live for television.
Yes.
And you saw it all. Can you believe that in this short period of time, everything just changed?
I think it's so sad. It's so unfortunate that other members of the royal family, well, of course they chose the institution over the two individuals because the institution 1066 and all that, you know, when the British monarchy began. But if you watch the first three episodes of the Harry and Meghan Netflix documentary, and again, that's all I've seen thus far, even in American Princess, which I had 1 month to write from HarperCollins because they wanted it all to be in galleys and come out before the royal wedding. It came out on April 18th of 2018, and the marriage was May 19th, my own anniversary. Yay! So it was fun to spend my anniversary with my husband in Windsor. I could only write in terms of what access I had, and then Meghan was really an unknown quantity. She was a little-known actress who had appeared on this CW network show that was shot in Toronto, you know, far from the madness of Los Angeles. And I watched and read what I perceived, and again, this is what comes out in the first three Netflix episodes, the racism of the British tabloid press. Terrible headlines. Harry's girlfriend is almost straight out of Compton, and my mother's family is from Southern California, and my uncle lives just a couple of blocks from where Meghan went to high school, in one of the most beautiful campuses. It's very similar to Stanford University with the stucco neo-Spanish classical buildings with the red tile roofs and sparkling swimming pools and these progressive, it's a Catholic high school, but it's run by very progressive nuns who believe in community service and outreach and drama programs and all kinds of things. And I also knew where her mother had a house that's referred to as the Black Beverly Hills, where the average home price is $750,000. So all of these articles about Meghan's mother were patently untrue. They were more fictional than my own novels are. And the British tabloid press, almost every single one of those tabloids is owned by Rupert Murdoch, as is the New York Post, for example, and the Fox News Network here. And I noticed that so many of the articles that came out, you know, had the same thumbprint. Inky thumbprint on them with this blatant racism. And I knew as soon as I heard that Meghan and Harry were dating, and this seemed to be a real love match because Meghan's personality was so much like Princess Diana's, and Harry was so much Princess Diana's son. He was warm, and he was huggy, and he cared about people, and he had started this charity in Africa, Santa Bale in Lesotho, where he and Princeso from Lesotho had both lost their mothers as young men, and it was a philanthropy that helped kids whose parents had died of AIDS or the kids developed AIDS as juveniles. And of course, that was one of Diana's big charities, and she was targeted as a pariah because of that, because she actually went into hospitals before people realized how that you can't catch AIDS just from touching an AIDS patient in the hospital. Harry started being, even when he was 15 years old, he was into the same charities and philanthropies that his mother was. He was really Diana's son more than Charles's son, and temperamentally, in terms of his very outgoing personality, in terms of his acceptance of broader swaths of humanity than Charles was, in terms of his hugginess. And Meghan was very much the same way. And when he and Meghan had their first date, apparently they just talked and talked sort of about saving the world. They had the same optic. And I knew just from the research that I could do in 4 weeks, that was all I was given by my publishers, to write American Princess, that this was a match made in heaven. These two were absolutely suited for each other temperamentally, of course, the physical attraction aside. And the press, the British press, was really out to destroy this because Meghan was an outsider. And the racism was, the headlines were obvious. It wasn't that Meghan was divorced an American. We'd been through the Wallace Simpson thing before. And Wallace Simpson, who had married the former King Edward VIII and had started dating him when she was married to her, still married to her second husband, Wallace had Nazi sympathy, as did Edward. And the forerunner to MI6 knew that. They had a dossier on her, and it makes me crazy when I see all these comparisons in print or some talk show host that doesn't know what they're talking about comparing Meghan to Wallace, because politically they couldn't be further apart. Everybody knew that Wallace was a Nazi and a fascist. When Wallace Simpson and Edward got married, they honeymooned. They got married on the estate of a man who was a munitions supplier to Hitler in France. They honeymooned in a rail car loaned to them by a guy that was a friend of Benito Mussolini. And they went to Germany for their honeymoon, where they were welcomed and feted by Adolf Hitler. Does that sound like Harry and Meghan to you?
No.
I mean, plus the fact that Harry is the spare. He has no set job. The second in line, he's not even second, he was second in line to the third to the line of the throne when he was a child. But now he's
fifth?
Sixth, seventh.
Sixth.
I mean, Harry has to forge his own path in the world, which he is doing by still being involved, like with the Invictus Games and involved in charities, which is what royals do when they're not going to be king. He's doing all the same things, even from America, that he was doing in England, except without the Fleet Street Press, which are the British tabloids, chasing him and Meghan the same way they chased Diana.
Well,
so he doesn't want to see history repeat itself. Harry is not a king who is going to abdicate his throne for the woman he loves. It is not remotely the same thing, Harry and Edward.
Well, you know, again, it's something that will be in, you know, you'll have more gossip and more things to add to your Audible books. So again, let's tell people they can get your Audible books and the entire series, there's going to be five of them, right?
Yes, there's going to be five of them. Royal Affairs, Notorious Royal Marriages, Royal Pains, Royal Romances, and Inglorious Royal Marriages. And the producer is Blackstone Audio, and so they can be on Audible or through Amazon or through Blackstone Audio's own website. And everything is available except for Royal Affairs, which comes out the second week in January.
Well,
and they make lovely gifts.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Delightful gifts, as do all of your books. Also, wonderful, wonderful. You know, the Marie Antoinette trilogy is just perfect, an ideal gift.
I have news for you now and your readers before we go, because I don't want to miss a trick. News about the Marie Antoinette trilogy.
Ooh.
Because I have fans that have asked me about this, because the first Marie Antoinette book, Becoming Marie Antoinette, is on audio. And in early 2023, I will be stepping into the audio booth to record books 2 and 3.
Fantastic.
For audiobook.
Oh, that's fantastic.
What? So sometime in the first half of 2023, the second and third book will be narrating them for audio.
Okay. Well, when they're out, when you have to come back, and we'll talk more about Marie Antoinette. We'll talk
without
more.
My wig. My Marie Antoinette wig.
That's it. Well, you know, Leslie, it's always so much fun to talk to you, and I know I will get emails from my listeners saying, "Oh, she's they." You know, you just bubble over when we talk about people bubbling with enthusiasm. That's you.
I just love it.
I know.
I love talking to you. I love this stuff, and I don't have time for the people who hate this stuff, because my feeling is just don't turn it on. Don't change the channel. Look at something else. There's so many other things to do.
That's right. And
don't hate. Life is too short. Don't hate.
Exactly. And in this season, I know that I want to wish you very, very happy holidays. And now that you're back in New York.
I'm so happy to be back.
I was going to say that. Oh, boy.
Am I happy to be back. I'm going to look at the windows in Bergdorf's, and I'm going to go down and look at the Rockefeller Center tree, and I'm going to bake cookies, and I could not be happier.
I know that. Oh, boy, oh, boy. To be in New York City, particularly at Christmas time, is fantastic. And New Year's Eve, my goodness, it's
Yes. My sister, did I ever tell you how my sister, she was, I think, 16, and she sneaked, we grew up in the Bronx, so with the trip to sneak out of the house and come downtown. She once sneaked out of the house and said, "Don't tell Daddy that I went downtown to Times Square." And then she was afraid she'd end up, you know, on camera when they pan around and look at the audience.
Well, it's just a joy to talk to you, and so a joyous, joyous holiday season to you and your husband, and I'm glad you're in New York City. I like to think of you in New York City, and when I get there, I always go to stay at the Algonquin, and...
Algonquin. My grandfather was a member of the Round Table.
Oh, my goodness. Next time you go there, would you do me a favor? Take a photo of yourself and send it to me, and I'll put it on my website, because I love the Algonquin Hotel. It is my place in New York City.
Oh, I will absolutely do that. He took me there when I was a little girl to meet with his editor when he started writing his own books and his memoirs. Well, his memoir is titled None of Your Business.
Well, you have to tell us more about that. You're going to come back. You have to tell us more about him, because that's fantastic.
Oh, he was a very famous radio writer. The golden age of radio. He wrote for Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and George
goodness.
Burns.
Well, you're going to be on when the Marie Antoinettes are done. You come back here. We'll have a whole hour. We'll talk about all of that, and we'll also talk about him. Okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patsy. I love talking to you, and I love your listeners.
Thank you. Bye bye now. Bye.
Bye bye. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, I'm out of here. I had so much fun. Both guests are fantastic. Wow, what a day! What a day, everybody. Have a lovely, lovely weekend. Get ready for the holidays. Do your shopping. Be careful out there. And say something nice to somebody. I say something nice to begin. I'm saluting him because I talked about Omar Bradley today. And I love Omar Bradley. Okay, bye-bye, everybody.